All units proceed to your post assignments. All units proceed to your post assignments.
Look at all those famous people. So prestigious. I wonder who's going to win this year. I think I missed Hitler. He was one of them. Ooh, the Pope. Trump. I remember that one. Greta. And our favorite weapons inspector. Congratulations, Scott.
Well, you must, thank you.
You must be very, very proud of yourself.
I'm fairly certain that was as fake as the applause.
that was unexpected. But now keep in mind that they say the award is not necessarily positive or negative. It's for the most influential person. So. You are a game changer, though. I think you changed people's minds about the Ukraine-Russia conflict. I'm pretty sure that's what it was about. President Biden has congratulated you. Let's hear what he has to say.
They may have made the wrong decision, and you brought it to light. We should address it. We should say straight up where we are, and we should do it. And for that, I thank you.
All right. So
we came to our milk.
What's that?
He said we need to come to our milk or something like that. So yeah,
I'm not sure what that means exactly. Well, this is the age of deep fakes. So you know, there's a lot of different memes going around and so forth. I've seen this quite a bit. Apparently, a lot of people thought it would be fun to play this prank and say that not only Zelensky won, but the spirit of Ukraine. I don't know how the spirit of Ukraine could be influential. So that's how we know it's a deep fake. Anyway, so you're taking it in stride, huh?
What, Zelensky winning man of the year?
You fell for the deep fake? I thought it was you. All right, so you're at an undisclosed location. And last week, your voice was a bit rough around the edges. How you feeling tonight?
Better. I mean, I'm in Washington, D.C. There's the disclosed location. Yesterday was the 35th anniversary of the signing of the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty. And we had a reunion of all the INF people who negotiated the treaty, people who backstopped it, were part of the support staff in the United States, and then people like me and others who were inspectors. And we came together and attended a formal luncheon. We had a State Department official speak and provide insight into the current thinking of the Biden administration regarding arms control. And I think this individual who will be unnamed because they spoke off the record, thought that they were walking into a sympathetic audience. And instead, after listening to this individual's speech, the questions that came out were basically like, what the hell are you guys up to? And this individual got very defensive, very quick, and basically, again, because of the respect for the request, you know, not to get into any details, but there is no arms control policy in the Biden administration. It's total chaos, total anarchy, total nothing. And that's a dangerous situation.
Yeah, and you have a new article about that in Energy Intelligence, and folks can find it by going to scottritterextra.com, and we're linking to it. Also, we should tell folks that next Friday night, Scott will be appearing at the Bethlehem Library in Del Mar, New York. And Friday night is when we usually have our date. So next week's podcast will be on Thursday night rather than Friday night. And the following week, even though it's getting close to Christmas, we're going to do it as scheduled. That's Friday the 23rd. But we are going to take the last week of December off. So no podcast on either Tuesday or Friday or any day that week. All right, let's see what our beloved Tori started her new job this week, and now has just come to a full week. How you doing, Tori? You there, baby?
Yep, I'm right here.
All right, feeling okay?
Yeah, feeling great.
All right, let's get to it. Okay. Axel from Finland, what are your thoughts about Viktor Bout and the trade that happened? It seems to me that his only notable crime was not being an international arms trader that brought suffering across the globe, but rather arming the Taliban that got Americans killed. This is referring to the basketball player trade.
Yes, Ms. Greiner. I think he was arrested under, if my understanding of the case is right, he was sort of set up by the, by American ATF agents and such. He never set foot in the United States, hadn't done anything, and it was sort of a sting operation. I think it shows the ludicrousness of the charge. If you're supposed to have exchange people of relative parity, to trade a international arms dealer guilty of massive crimes against humanity, et cetera, for a girl who left, a THC vaping pen or something in her bag. I think it just shows how trumped up the charge was. For his family, I'm glad he's home. For Brittany Griner's family, I'm glad she's home. I'm glad that the United States and Russia were able to reach an accommodation here. But if anybody thinks this changes anything, it doesn't. The state of affairs between the United States and Russia is horrible. And there's nothing going on in the Biden administration that suggests that there's going to be anything that is going to change that trajectory anytime soon.
Okay. I can't remember if we were just talking before the podcast or if we told the audience that you're in Washington now at a hotel. That's why it's a different backdrop than usual. Did we talk about it? I'll be okay. Butthead, on my sofa, just read your piece on the measuring device situation in your book. Just wanted to say brilliant. That's not exactly a question, but why don't you explain what Butthead is referring to?
On his sofa. Well, I think he's talking about the stage measuring device, which was a contraption that the Soviets had constructed to help us get inside. The Soviets weren't thrilled about us X-raying their missiles and the INF treaty, because the factory that we're monitoring produced a missile, the SS-25, whose first stage was similar to that of the first stage of the prohibited SS-20. And that's an SS-20 on the front cover of the book there. The way that we were going to distinguish this was to X-ray the missile canister in a rail car. So we have to install this giant X-ray called cargo scan, millions of dollars. And the Soviets didn't like the idea of X-ray, whether or not we could do damage. It was supposed to be non-damaging, whether or not we could collect more intelligence about the missile than we were supposed to under the treaty. They just were unhappy. So they were looking for alternatives. And one of their alternatives was this stage measuring device, which is this long, we called it sticks and mirrors, basically wooden device with some mirrors and some lighting, and you'd stick it inside the missile and peer down and then look in periscopes and measure specific areas. The they had presented it to people, and then we said we needed to examine it closely, more closely. So it was shipped to the United States in a crate, a sealed crate, and it arrived in JFK out of the blue, and customs seized it. Now, it's a sealed, diplomatically inviolable crate. If the seal is broken, then there's no guarantee that what was shipped to the Soviets is that which arrives unaltered in Sandia, New Mexico. So the crate can't be opened. It's supposed to be released to us, but the customs people said, we're not releasing it. We have to inspect it. So out of the blue, I arrived at work, and Marine Corps Colonel Connell, Ritter, stay there, don't move. I stood in the hallway, and he and the general talked, and then he ordered me to get on an airplane and fly to JFK and call him when I got there. So I did. He said, you got to go to cargo, to customs, and free up this box and get it on a waiting Air Force plane and out of there, and the box can't be opened. Yes, sir. So I go there, and as soon as I walk in, the customs guys look at me, and I said, I don't care if you send the entire damn Marine Corps, I'm not releasing this box. And, you know, I can't call back to the colonel and say, well, the customs guy won't release it. You know, so I've got to get it released. And so I called his bluff. I had met a White House science advisor, a Marine Corps colonel, and I had his business card. So I brought the card out, put it on the table. I said, look, we can do it the easy way or the hard way. Easy way is you release this to me. The hard way is you do understand this is the President of the United States treaty. This is the treaty he signed. It's a treaty he wants implemented, and you're about to screw it up. So I'm going to pick up the phone. I'm going to call the White House. I'm going to give them your name. And I'm going to say, you're the one screwing this up. Then they're going to call your boss, and you're going to get a phone call from your boss. And that's probably the end of your career. So how do you want to do this? So I picked up the phone, and I'm bluffing. And I start down that number, trying to figure out what I'm going to say when the White House answers. And halfway through, he puts his finger on the cradle and says, all right, maybe we can reach an accommodation. He said, are you willing to sign for the crate? I said, yes, that's what I'm. So he brought out some documentation, and I signed it over to me, and he gave me the crate. So far, so good. But now I got to get the crate out of JFK. So I call up the Air Force guys that are outside in their plane. I say, okay, load the crate up, and you guys fly off. They load the crate up, and they come back, and they go, well, we can't take off. The traffic pattern's full. It's going to take hours. Well, I didn't have hours. I was told to get the plane in the air. So I remembered one more meeting I had been to in the State Department where we were talking about designating intermediate nuclear forces flights coming in from the Soviet Union with priority numbers, info 001, and it would give them priority access. So I went to the guy and I said, redesignate your flight, info 001, and ask for permission to take off. He said, on whose authority? I said, mine. So he did, and instantly all aircraft over the East Coast stopped, and he takes off, and it disrupted the pattern everywhere. But he's off and he's there. So I call up the colonel and say, the plane's on its way. But I said, you might get some phone calls. By the time I got back to Washington, D.C., the White House had already called wondering what the hell some lieutenants running around using their name in vain. And the FAA was calling around finding out who the hell authorized this plane to change its call sign. They disrupted air traffic all up and down the East Coast. And so the general was going to fire me, but the colonel reminded him that they had given me an order to do something no matter what. And so I did something no matter what. I got the crate on the plane, but I broke a lot of rules. So I think that's what he's talking about.
Okay. You can read all sorts of great stories in Scott's book, Disarmament in the Time of Perestroika, Arms Control and the End of the Soviet Union. Kamal from New Delhi. I have friends from Donetsk that have fled after their flat in the center came under heavy shelling from AFU and are now in Krasnodar and completely traumatized. I give them hope that all this will end soon. So for them, I ask you, when will this shelling of Donetsk end?
Hopefully soon, but I mean, in order for it to end, the Russians are going to have to clear out some of the most heavily defended areas in the world. Right now, there's a big battle going on for Bakhmut and some other towns. They're part of the Ukrainian defensive belt. So these belts will have to be cleaned out, and then the Ukrainians will have to be pushed out of the whole Donetsk Republic and then back even further to a distance that represents the range of their available artillery system, so that even if they fire artillery, it won't be able to reach Donetsk proper because they've been pushed out of range. I think in order to do that, Russia is going to require the totality of the mobilized troops to come in. Putin indicated that 175,000 of them had already been arrived, and they were awaiting the remaining 125,000 to come in. And once that happens, I think you're going to see offensive operations. So timeline, I would say probably sometime, you know, either at the end of this month, early next month, something's going to start, and it'll take them, you know, a couple weeks, a couple months to finish it. But, you know, one way or the other, I think it's going to be over by this summer.
All right. Some real life concerns for people living in the danger zone while we sit comfortably here in the U.S. Dennis in Cleveland. History doesn't repeat itself, but it often rhymes. That's a Mark Twain quote. And Dennis asks, are these similarities to the Soviet-Finnish Winter War of 1930? Are there similarities to the Soviet-Finnish Winter War of 1939 and 40? And he gives three examples. The Soviets invaded over security concerns. The Soviets initially had flawed tactical strategy and got beaten badly. And the Soviets redid their strategy and then beat the Finns decisively.
I mean, superficially, this is true. the Winter War, though, wasn't a special military operation. We have to keep in mind that the Soviets call what they're doing in Ukraine a special military operation, and a large part of the special aspect comes from the relationship that the Soviet Union or that the Russians have with the Ukrainian people because of the Soviet Union, because of their history, culture, etc., which has caused them to, at least in the past, take a softer approach. The Finns don't have the same cultural, linguistic, religious, historical linkage with Russia as the Ukrainians did. So I think that it's a lot more complicated than just the superficiality of saying Russians attacked, Russians got beat, Russia's regrouped, Russia resumed attack, Russia wins decisively. I mean, that of course appears to be a model that's repeating itself, but the complexity of the Russian-Ukrainian relationship, I think, makes what's happening in Ukraine today far more unique.
Okay. Could you ask everybody in your hotel to stop using the internet so we get a better signal? Would that be possible?
I could, if you'd like. I mean,
just go door to door, man.
Yeah.
Actually, we can hear and see you for the most part. It's just cutting out a little bit intermittently. Not really that bad. Okay, let's go to the next question. Roberto from Milano. That's how they say Milan in Italy. What if, you knew that, right? What if Ukraine is never allowed to surrender? Even after total defeat, Russia could and will win this war clearly, and the West still could claim victory. What might be the consequences?
Well, I mean, I can't imagine a scenario where Ukraine will never be allowed to surrender. If Russia wins this this conflict, as they appear they're going to do, Russia will be dictating the terms of conflict termination. I think the implication there is that, similar to what happened in April, where Ukrainians and the Russians were meeting in Istanbul, and they were, both sides seemed prepared to come to agreement that would bring an end to the conflict. But the British with the American support, Boris Johnson flew in and terminated that discussion, and told the Ukrainians that you can't surrender, you can't reach a peace agreement, or else you won't get any of this aid that we're providing you. And so I think that what they're talking about is that the West will never allow a negotiated settlement. But here's the flaw in that argument. Russia may not allow a negotiated settlement. At this point in time, Russia doesn't trust anybody. Angela Merkel now has been exposed as being a fraud from day one. It was an outright lie, her claims of trying to negotiate a ceasefire, a termination of the conflict. She was just buying time for the Ukrainian military to be built so they could launch follow-on military operation. So there's no negotiating partner in the West that Russia would trust. And a key aspect to any negotiation is trust. You have to be able to trust the people that you're negotiating with, that they're going to be honorable and have integrity. Merkel's a liar. Germany's liars. French are liars. Americans are liars. So there is no one that Russia can negotiate with, nor does Russia want to negotiate with Ukraine anymore. This has gone far too, this war has gone on far too long, too many casualties. The Ukrainians have committed too many crimes. So I think the, any talk about a negotiated settlement is simply the West having a discussion with the West. It's an intramural conversation, because the Russians aren't in the business of doing negotiated settlement. Negotiation means you're going to give something up. What is Russia going to give up? They're winning. And they can't be certain that they reach this agreement, that the agreement will be complied with. We know that the West will negotiate one thing, not meaning it at all. So why would Russia enter into a negotiation when the best solution for Russia is just to terminate this conflict on its terms by defeating Ukraine decisively?
David from Bellevue, Washington. Given that the Banderite movement was able to survive in Western Ukraine for decades during Soviet times, how can Russia hope to succeed in their goal of denazification now?
Well, let's recall that Russia decisively defeated the military arm of the Western Ukrainian nationalists by 1954. And many thousands of Western Ukrainians were imprisoned and then granted amnesty by Nikita Khrushchev. And then they returned home. And of course, rather than seeking to rejoin the normal society, they began to reorganize and receive help from the West, et cetera, from this giant Ukrainian nationalist diaspora that exists in Canada, the United States, and elsewhere. I think somebody had up there, about Mark Twain, a history doesn't have to repeat, but it can rhyme. That's a derivative of, those who fail to learn the lessons of history are doomed to repeat them. The Russians have learned the lesson of history, is that you cannot re-educate and then return to society hardcore Nazis. Denazification is going to require the physical termination of this movement. And so I think that's the difference. In the 1950s, Russia was seeking an accommodation that would have people be re-educated and reintroduced in society. And I don't think that that's going to be an option for too many people in this next phase of denazification.
Paul Wolf, Washington, D.C. He may be right in your neighborhood now, for all we know. The Russians have been asking for a new European security framework as one of their demands to end the Ukraine war. What kind of framework could bring stability to Europe? Could it be something that replaces NATO completely?
Well, the Russians have already answered that question. On December 17th of 2021, Russia provided two draft treaties. One was a bilateral treaty between the United States and Russia for a new European security framework. And the second is a multilateral agreement that Russia was trying to implement with NATO in Europe. So we know what a Russian-European security framework is. We know what they want. It doesn't require the disbandment of NATO, but it does require a different NATO mindset when it comes to the issue of how far forward leaning does NATO want to be. Do they want to really be on the Russian doorstep leaning forward, or are they going to be willing to create a buffer of perceived neutrality that separates Russia from the West? So we know what it looks like. The question isn't, you know, how Russia's going to define it. Russia's already defined it. The question is, at what point in time is Europe going to wake up that the only way out of this nightmare is to pursue, in writing, a European security framework along the lines which were put forward by Russia in December of last year.
Okay. Do you have anything to drink tonight, Scott?
Diet Coke.
All right. Just want to make sure you can wet your whistle because I hear you coughing. Robert Sheets from Youngstown. I believe Youngstown is in Ohio. Not sure. Given your harsh criticism of Ukrainians and the cowards that just go along with things, what would you say of the owner of Bandera's dog, and especially the military that feeds, trains, sharpens its teeth, and slips the leash? Still Semper Fi? You undercut the moral force of your own discourse. What an odd message / question.
I'll say the following. Any Ukrainian who defines Ukrainian nationalism along the ideology of Stepan Bandera is evil. It's an odious ideology. It's an ideology that needs to be eradicated from the face of the earth, and Russia is actively pursuing that objective. That's what I have to say about that. Now, I think he's somehow trying to link that or parlay it away or whatever by comparing the American policy of supporting Ukraine against Russia. And somehow, I don't understand his question, to be honest.
I don't think I either.
Am I failing to criticize America enough? Or what do you say about the owner of Bandera's dog? Who's the owner of Bandera's dog? Is America the owner of Bandera's dog? Is that what he's implying? The military that feeds, trains, and sharpens his teeth. So I think he's talking about either the American military or NATO, and slips the leash, which tells them to go forward. Still Semper Fi, always faithful. You undercut the moral force of your own discourse. Let me tell you something, Robert Sheets. If you want to play fucking games about the Marine Corps, come and do it in my face. I'll Semper Fi your ass straight to the grave. Undercut the moral force of my own discourse? Maybe. I'm not here to play moral games or whatever. Keep the Marine Corps out of this fucking thing. All right? You want to talk about American policy? Let's talk about American policy. You want to talk about Ukraine and Bandera? We can talk about Ukraine again. Unless you served in the Marine Corps, and you didn't, because you would never say that if you did, then you have no right to talk about it. If you think you have a right to talk about it, you know where I live, hunt me down, and we can talk about faith. I'm tired of this nonsense, idiots. Ask a question about Ukrainian policy, about American policy. Why do you have to make it personal? Why do you have to bring in the Marine Corps? You don't understand what the Marine Corps is. You don't understand what the Marine Corps is about. You don't understand anything, because if you did, you wouldn't dare bring it up. I apologize, Jeff, but
that's okay. You know what? I think Robert is full of Sheets. It's right there in his name. What do you expect from anybody in the whole?
He wrote that question because he wanted to get me mad. And you know what? I fell into the trap. I was doing so good. I was calm, but then I saw Semper Fi, and that just drove me insane. Right.
Then now you're up Sheets Creek. Okay. Mary from Massachusetts.
All right, Mary.
Massachusetts, by the way, is a commonwealth. That's very different from a state. I don't know if you're aware of that. What are the possible options for the U.S. to get out of supporting Ukraine? Is there a face-saving ploy the Biden or a future administration could use? That's a nice civil question. Look at Mary's
Mary, thank you for that civil question. We're beyond face saving. I mean, when you don't dispatch 50, 60, 70, 80, I don't know what the limit is now, $1 billion and then walk away. They put it, the U.S. isn't going to save face. It's going to be ugly no matter what, just like Afghanistan was ugly no matter what. By the time we made the decision to get out of Afghanistan, it was going to be embarrassing no matter what we did. So someone has to ask the important question. So the Russia is going to make this easy for the United States by winning the war. Now, you know, it's interesting because I had this conversation with Konstantin Sivkov, who said that Russia was, it was the first time I heard it articulated by somebody of his of that stature, et cetera, that, you know, Russia was in very concerned about escalation management, that while, yes, purely militarily speaking, Russia could, you know, wipe the slate clean, that Russia was concerned about lager. Okay, lager. Well, but well, the winter lager that puts out, that Sam Adams puts out, is a very good lager, so I'll drink that. but, you know, so a war is politics by other means. And maybe the political situation in Russia is more complex than it probably is. I mean, we're having a conversation here that where you try to dumb things, not dumb things down, but simplify things and streamline answers, et cetera, or else I could just go off on tangent after tangent after tangent. But I don't see a situation where the Russians are going to throw away, because anything less than total military victory leaves the Russians with the cancer of Ukraine remaining. This Ukraine is a cancer that must be excised now. The tumor must be removed. And short of that, the cancer remains, and you're still in, you know, have an infected, diseased European body. So I think Russia, while managing escalation to keep NATO from being sucked into the conflict, is going to win the conflict. And when that happens, then the United States walk away from Ukraine, just like we did from Afghanistan. I mean, we literally walked away. And I think that's what we're going to end up doing with Ukraine, just walking away.
Jackie Le Chevalier, Argentina. I'm past the point of trying to understand German politicians. They are hopeless. But German industrialists? There's no way they didn't see this coming. What happened?
That's the million-dollar question. It's a very good question. We know the German industrialists saw this coming because at least one of them gave a high-profile interview where he called it out, called out the insanity. But, you know, German industry has been making compromises to in the name of German politics, especially when it comes to green energy industrial practices that reduce carbon footprints and all that stuff. And so I think the industry was caught up in the entire policy debate and remained silent. They should have spoken out. I mean, they're being drummed out of business. They're closing down. One in four German heavy industry jobs may flee Germany this winter. So, where were the German industrialists? That's just a very fair question.
We get some great questions, not from the Sheets family, but otherwise we do. Alex, Toronto, when do you think the Russian large-scale offensive might be coming? Is there any intelligence information on concentration of Russian forces indicative of that offensive happening soon? Or are those troops still on training grounds?
Yeah. I don't think the offensive begins until Russia has assembled all the resources necessary for the offensive. So as long as a number of them remain in their final stages of military preparation, I don't think a major offensive is going to occur, because you don't want to initiate something unless you have assurances that all of the resources you need to follow up on that are available. So I do believe that we're going to be waiting until the remaining 125,000 finish up their final training, their organization, their checking out, et cetera. And then they should be arriving later this month, early next month. And the thing is about, it's like anything. I mean, take a boxer. A boxer, trains so that on fight day, they're at peak performance capability, peak performance potential. You don't want to overtrain and burn out before the fight, and you don't want to undertrain so that you're not at peak performance. You want to be at peak. That's That's the same way combat is. You need to have your forces at peak performance potential when you want to start this conflict. And one way to lose peak performance potential is to deploy troops during wintertime into forward areas and then have them sit around and do nothing. So Russia is training this massive, offensively oriented force. And I imagine once it gets assembled in the forward areas, they're going to want to transition as rapidly as possible into into major offensive operations because they're at peak performance potential. But the longer they wait in position, that the capacity gets reduced. So I believe that this offensive is going to be sooner rather than later.
I don't mean to trivialize your modus operandi at all, but I notice that there are similarities between your analysis and the way sports analysts talk about things sometimes. Do you think that's a fair comparison, or do you now hate me more than you even did before?
No. I use sports analogies. They're easier for some people to understand. If I sat here and I think we did it once, I got into the discussion about the tip fiddle. Do we really want to have another discussion about the tip fiddle? Look, I will say this, the war is 400 million times more complicated than sports. But basic principles are basic principles. Your military professional is a war fighting athlete. And so there's a lot that's going to, not just the physical preparation, but there's the logistical preparation. There's all the stuff, that goes into it, all have to be at peak performance. You can't, it's like managing a football team or a baseball team. You can't just have the quarterback being good. You have to have the line working. You have to have the backs working. You have to have the receivers working, special teams, everything has to work. And, you have to have your trainers on board. You have to have your aircraft flying. You got to get the team there on time. So it's a whole system that has to be at peak performance for this to work properly. And that's the military, too. It all has to be at peak performance.
I also think that sometimes certain people in the public treat it like it's an athletic competition or something like that. And they're rooting for or against people they don't feel the consequences themselves. But you always speak in terms of, real life and death reality of it.
Right. I mean, that's the danger. We're having a podcast here. We need to come up with a kit that we can mail out. And it's going to, it's going to be, it's not just a hairdryer, but one that's really, really hot. And then we need also the opposite of that, one that's really, really cold. And before we start the podcast, we're going to go through a regime where people freeze themselves. And then they heat themselves, they get blisters. We want them to be totally dehydrated. But before they do this, they have to stay awake for 3 days. And then we have this kit where you take sand and you rub the sand in your eyes. So your eyes are bloody and all this stuff. And then I'm going to you have to attach these electrodes to your body. And randomly, we're just going to hit a button and shock them and all that. And every once in a while, there's going to be something that comes in and slices them so they bleed a little bit too. And then we can talk about war. So now they might even begin to understand that it's not an athletic event, that it's life and death, and that it's real, and there's deadly serious consequences attached to it. And every time you say USA, USA, as if this is a sporting event, you should probably go and, I don't want to say anything bad, but you should disengage from life for a while. Because it's not a sporting event, and people who treat it like a sporting event are they're wrong. And and that mindset actually furthers the potential of conflict, because by minimizing the actual human cost, we treat it like an athletic event. So we can't wait for the next game. We can't wait for the next event. I mean, sometimes I get no offense to anybody. And sometimes I come across the same, I understand. But the question, when is the offensive going to come? What we should really be saying is, when are hundreds of thousands of people going to die violently? Because that's what we're talking about. It's, yeah, you know, it's not when is Miami going to win the Super Bowl? You know, maybe this year, but it's when are hundreds of thousands of people going to die violently? That's what we're talking about, you know, and people need to start realizing that, you know, well, from a policy standpoint, maybe the large scale offensive is attractive to bring an end to this conflict. The cost, the human cost that's going to be paid by both sides, is mind-boggling.
Valentina from Zagreb. That's Croatia?
Zagreb, yes, very good.
All right. Why didn't the Russian air defense systems detect and shoot down the two Ukrainian drones that attempted to hit Rezon and Engels air bases sooner than they did? Is there military logic to permit enemy projectiles to penetrate deep inside one's territory?
Well, I'll answer the second part first. No, there's no military logic.
Is that Croatian sarcasm, or is that a real question?
I think she's basically saying that what is Russia up to? You know, why can't Russia shoot down these drones? The irony is that the Tupolev 141 drone is designed to be fired and detected by radar so that surface-to-air missiles can shoot it down. It's a target drone. So it's designed to be shot down. So if that's what it's designed to be doing, why aren't the Russians shooting it down? And the answer is that it was converted from its target drone configuration into a ground attack drone, a kamikaze drone, suicide drone, etc. It didn't fly the trajectory that one would expect a airborne target to fly, which is to go up, get at altitude, and it entered. And I'd have to see the radar track. I would imagine that if it flew in a straight line, that if I took my protractor out there and plotted every Russian radar and its range and I did circles, I'd see that it would probably have flown through a whole bunch of intersecting arcs of radars, which indicate it should have been shot down a long time ago. I'm guessing that this attack was done in coordination with NATO intelligence on Russian air defense radars, that they found a seam, and that this air defense drone, instead of flying its predictable straight course, was actually programmed to fly a point-to-point, you know, spider-webbing its way in through the gaps in the radar to get to the target to avoid detection. According to the New York Times, Ukrainian deep reconnaissance group was actually near one of the airfields in question. And you have to ask yourself why. I mean, if they're there because of this attack, what purpose did they serve? They're not target acquisition, because the targets have already been acquired by overhead imagery. And the path going in has been, pre-planned. My only thing I can come up with is terminal guidance. And what that means is, as the drone approaches the target, somebody is going to direct it onto the specific target they want hit, terminal guidance. And this implies laser designation, that the airplane had some sort of laser, the ability to follow a beam of a laser beam down to the target. The target's being designated by somebody on the ground with a beam, the reflection, and the drone is going to follow that into the target. And if this is the case, then Russia has something a little bit more to worry about than a drone penetrating its air defense. How the heck did a Ukrainian special forces team get that close to a nuclear strategic airfield, close enough to laser designate for terminal guidance of this drone? This is a significant problem for the Russians. They do need to figure out how this happened so that it doesn't happen again from their perspective. For the Ukrainians' perspective, I guess they'd like to repeat this often. But once again, we do have to understand the seriousness. This was an airfield with Russia's strategic nuclear bomber force. And one of the conditions that Russia has for the release of nuclear weapons is an attack against its strategic nuclear deterrent designed to prevent Russia from implementing its plans. So if you carried out a really good, capable attack against the airfield, you could trigger a nuclear response by Russia. So maybe the people that planned this attack on the airfield might want to reconsider doing something like that in the future, because you're tickling the dragon or the bear.
I misjudged your pause for the conclusion to your answer. I believe you have now concluded, and I will boldly move on to the next question from Paul in Ottawa. John Helmer at Dances with Bears claims that the Ukraine conflict will end with a Korean-style armistice rather than a formal peace, resulting in a 100-kilometer-wide Ukrainian demilitarized zone splitting the country in two. Does this scenario seem plausible?
No. One, it would require Russia to give up on the new European security framework that underpins the entire reason why they're doing this operation. Two, Russia, one of the goals of the special military operation was to end the imminent threat posed by Ukraine against Donetsk and Lugansk, the Donbass. you don't terminate that threat if you have a Korean-style armistice. As I said earlier, the cancer needs to be excised, removed. The scenario that just laid out right there is a strategic Russian defeat. And I don't see Russia terminating this conflict on terms like that. I don't think Russia terminates this conflict with anything less than a strategic Russian victory. And that will require the destruction of the Ukrainian military, the elimination of the current regime in Kiev, and there won't be this cancerous cell remaining in territory they call out Ukraine with any kind of buffer zone. That's my opinion. Could I be wrong? Absolutely. I mean, I could be wrong, and maybe Russia doesn't have the ability to accomplish what I just laid out, and if this offensive sputters and that's where Russia finds itself, then maybe a scenario like that becomes attractive. But right now, I just can't imagine under any circumstance Russia allowing the conflict to end on those terms.
Are you staying in the kind of hotel where they come in and turn down the bed for you at night, or and leave little candies on the pillow and that kind of thing?
No.
I used to work in hotels, you know, so and those type, very, very upscale, you know, like the best hotels in the world, actually. We're at the Carlisle, you know about the Carlisle in New York.
Oh, yeah.
I worked at the Carlisle for 3 years. I was just flashing back to that. I always thought that turning down the bed was like ridiculous, overkill. Like, who the hell needs somebody to pull down the blanket for them?
I spoke in a at this event in Aspen, Colorado. It was a big deal, and all the big names in the world were there. And I stayed at this hotel that was five-star elite hotel with the turndown service you talk about.
Yeah.
So they turned down and they put the mints on the bed. So I come in a late flight, and I literally just shut the door and I fall down on the bed and fall asleep. And in the morning I wake up, I got chocolate all over my face and my hair and all, because I fell asleep on the mints. That was it, man. And the bed just looked like somebody committed chocolate murder. It was horrible.
I've only worked at hotels like that. I've never been a guest, but I would feel like it's intrusive. Like, get the hell out of here. I know how to pull down the blanket myself. You know.
Or, but if you're going to put the mint on, put it on the nightstand. Yeah.
So the weapons inspector doesn't have a messy face in the morning.
Yeah.
Jimmy Dimmick, Moscow. Russian officers from the front lines are confirming that the vast majority of the dead Ukrainians are Terra Barona, which I guess is sort of like reserves, hence untrained civilians, and that the trained combat units are being kept safe in the back. Are these still U.S. NATO instructions? If so, why?
Well, I don't know what's going on right now. I do know that, I've read that when the Ukrainians were building up their reserves, they would pull some of the more experienced units out of the line so they can get trained, re-equipped, etc. And they would place them with these territorial battalions, which are just basically, you know, recently conscripted, poorly trained troops whose sole job was to put bodies in a trench and keep, you know, sacrifice blood for time. I don't know what section of the battlefield he's talking about, because, you know, some of the most violent combat right now is taking place in the vicinity of Bakhmut. And from what I've read, some of the best Ukrainian units have been committed to that sector of the battlefield. And your mercenaries are there, the Poles are there. So anything but the territorial battalion. So I don't know what he's saying. Is it NATO instructions? I think that is more a decision made by the Ukrainians in terms of it's just a necessity that is derived from the reality of force composition. They don't have a middle ground. They have either regular army or units like the Azov battalion that are odious in terms of ideology, but they have a modicum of combat capability, or they have these untrained territorial units. So if you're pulling the regular army out to get trained, the only thing you have left to replace them with is the territorial battalions.
Okay. Somebody's thanking you for being such a trooper, even when you're sick.
Just so people know, I'm not sick, but just we had we had this reunion last night, and didn't have a drink. I was so in all of us, because we're old. We had a beer. Some people had a glass of whiskey, but that ended quickly, and we had Diet Coke. But we were playing poker, and they broke out the cigars. And so I was literally surrounded by people smoking cigars, and it permeated every aspect of my life, including my lungs. And so this is what cigar asphyxiation sounds like. Wow. Kids, don't smoke cigars. You'll sound like Uncle John.
But aside from your voice, you feel okay?
Well, I've got the congestion, the cigar congestion.
Okay. All right. Well, we don't have to go as long as usual tonight if you want.
No. I'm here for the team.
All right. Typing Monkey, who hangs out at the Literary Zoo. Have you ever been there?
No.
Me neither. Everybody says that generals fight the last war. Do you have any ideas how war will be the same or different in, say, 10 years from now? That's an interesting question. Also, I hear you have a new book. Could you please tell us something about it?
Jeff, ask me about my book.
Why do I have to ask you about it? Typing Monkey just did.
That book right there, Disarming the Time of Perestroika, Arms Control and the End of the Soviet Union.
You don't mind if I go for glass number two tonight of the Portuguese wine, do you? I love this wine. It's very
Jeff, fun. I hope you go from glass number two to bottle number two. You deserve just unwind.
There we go. It's not
Disarm the Time Perestroika is the book that's about the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, the foundational treaty that for on-site inspection based verification. It made real disarmament possible, because it gave confidence that the agreements would be carried out, because we would have actual people on the ground confirming this. And I was one of those people. So, I played a big role in this. And so it's that story told through, my experience and the experience of others. But in addition to just being a really cool piece of history and hopefully an entertaining read, it's also, I view a template of success that could be applied to the situation we face today with Russia and the United States and the need for arms control. A lot of people say it's just too hard right now. You know, nobody's talking, nobody's negotiating, there's no trust, and that's all true, but it was that bad back in the 80s too, and yet we found a way to do this. So I'm hopeful we'll be able to find a way going forward. So that was the book part of the question. The other part of the question was...
We can add that back to you.
General Strike, the Last War, How the War We Saved. Well, let's put it this way. you know, one thing that's new about this war is the level of drones. There's never been a war fought by Russia or Ukraine or NATO where drones have been incorporated to this degree. You know, so, you know, the generals, you know, the Russians are fighting a war that's based upon doctrine that was perfected in during World War II, their artillery doctrine, and they've fine-tuned it in Chechnya, in Syria, etc. But, you know, there's some new technologies coming in that that require these tactics to be altered and modified and et cetera. So, but I it looks like the Russians and the Ukrainians are adapting relatively quickly so that we're not getting, you know, they don't appear to be totally trapped in the last war. It looks like both sides are actually getting ready to fight, you know, the present war based upon present technological reality. So it's fascinating from that perspective to watch everybody learn these lessons rapidly and adapt new technologies. It's tragic from a human perspective because what we call learning is fighting, and fighting is killing, and people are dying.
What about non-military use of drones? It seems to me there can be a lot of nefarious uses for them, and they're not that expensive. So should we be worried about that?
I think so. I mean, drones are, I mean, we see how intrusive they are on the battlefield. You know, there's no place to hide when a drone's hovering over. And there's drones that aren't conducive to visual you know, monitoring, and, you know, right now we see the drone come in and drop the grenade and everybody's like, ooh, isn't that sexy? But, or we see the kamikaze drone fly into an artillery piece and blow itself up. We see the guy Shahid 136 go in and hit strategic infrastructure targets, and we're like, cool. But there are drones that just do electronic warfare and fly over and jam signals, or they simulate in the air, they will simulate being a cell tower receiver, and they'll enter, you know, they'll get mimic capabilities. So cell phones come to them, and then they use that GPS locating aspect on the cell phone to find out where the other guy is, send that off to artillery or airstrike to kill it. That technology, though, can be used against us.
Could be used for almost anything, it seems.
Yeah. If I want to intercept, your phone call, Jeff, I could put a drone over your house that mimics a cell tower and captures your phone signal and all that. And we know that
is there much regulation of drones?
There's supposed to be regulation of drones in terms of flight and the potential of impacting civilian or commercial airliners. There's also supposed to be, but what there isn't right now is restriction on collection and stuff like that. So it's information collection.
You mean in terms of drones being used for that purpose? Is that what you're talking about?
I think drones can be used for that purpose. Imaging. And let's say I'm in my backyard.
Fly over somebody's office window and with a camera.
Take a picture.
I can
take up my drone off from my yard and fly around my neighborhood. And, you know, people put fences up in the yards, but a drone can fly over and take photographs down there. It's very intrusive. It's a violation. To me, it seems like a violation of privacy.
You're getting some advice from our angel in Quebec. Scott's a beer man. Yes. You don't usually go for liquor, do you?
I don't, but vodka could be
for medicinal purposes.
medicinal purposes only.
By the way, Richie, it continues to be a problem, but so far, every single time I turn my email program off, no problem at all. So I just want to ask you to think about that. He's helping me with a computer problem. So if that's further evidence, Richie, so I'll get rid of the email program if it looks like that's what it is. All right, let's go to the next question. Joy R. from Queensland.
That's the same question we just asked.
Oh, it is. All right. Queensland is in Australia, I believe. Is that correct? Yeah. Bob from BC, that would be British Columbia or perhaps Boston College. How does Zelensky organize his inner circle? And is the Ukrainian government still meeting in the Verkhovna Rada, which I guess is their parliament or the
parliament?
Yes. Yeah.
You know, Zelensky's inner circle has gone through several iterations from the team that he first brought on after his election. They failed to implement any meaningful policy. So he purged that team and created an inner circle of insiders, people he trusts. And the more and more complexity, failure, incompetence that his government displayed in terms of defining policy and seeking to implement the policy, the more he's culled and handpicked people from, for instance, who supported him when he was a comedian, things like that, people who aren't necessarily the foreign policy experts, but they're going to come in because he trusts them. And we see this going on now. He has war cabinet, et cetera, and it's people that he trusts because this is no longer a democracy. This is no longer a normal functioning government. This is a virtual dictatorship run by a president who, has suppressed all political opposition, shut down political media, shut down political parties, etc. Yes, the Rada meets, the parliament meets on things, but by and large, this is martial law, and so presidential decrees, can be done, of course, without the consent of parliament.
Richie just extended another great offer. We got to do something for this guy. What do you give to the man who has everything? We're gonna go there. Maybe give him go to Quebec and give him a shoulder massage. Take him out to dinner or something. I don't know.
I could take him out to dinner. You can do the shoulder massage.
All right. All right, Tor, you got some good questions for the weapons inspector. He says he wants to keep going even though he can barely speak. The man is a trooper. That's it for our pre-planned questions. Let's take some live questions now from our angel in Quebec. Thoughts on Merkel playing 3D chess, aiding Russia by outing the West's true intentions to ignore Minsk II, or is she just a fool?
She's just a fool. She's humiliated herself and humiliated Germany. The Russians, they believed her. I mean, one of the greats about Angela Merkel was the fact that she had an ability to sit down with Putin and discuss things based upon mutual trust that other Western leaders couldn't do. So, Angela Merkel was able to be seen as a serious interlocutor. There's a lot of syllables in there. I might have thrown in an additional one. But and she just threw that away. She's pretty much said, everything I did with Putin was a lie. Everything. And it's, how can Germany ever be trusted again? How can Europe ever be trusted again? A key aspect of diplomacy is the issue of trust. There has to be trust. And there can be no trust with Germany ever again. Not ever again, but with as it operates, is Germany just buying time again? Is this yet another sham? And here's the other thing. It's not that Merkel just embarrassed German relations with Russia. On the strength of Germany's guarantees about Minsk, they went to the Security Council of the United Nations and they got the Security Council to weigh in with a resolution about Minsk as well. she disgraced international law. She was lying to the Security Council. She stands for nothing, nothing. Germany stands for nothing. France, nothing. And now we have Germany and France saying, oh, we need to start being serious about Russia's legitimate national security concerns, and we need to be talking about a European security framework that incorporates Russia's concerns. Why would anybody ever trust her again? Trust France? This is foolish on her. But there's no 3D chess going on. This is just plain stupidity. And the reason why she's speaking out right now, again, isn't out of some noble obligation or concern about history, anything that's beneficial. It's because she is seeing her legacy attacked. And so being the narcissist that she is, apparently, she's trying to come in and defend her legacy by distancing herself from Putin and from Russia, because she's being deemed as being too close to Putin. So she's basically saying, oh, no, I wasn't that close. You see, everything I was doing was just, it was to buy time for Ukraine. It was to do this, that. It wasn't me really being close to Putin. I have no respect for her anymore. I mean, she was somebody that you could say, for 16 years, she carried out policy based upon conviction, integrity, et cetera. You can never use her name and integrity again in the same sentence.
You are technically correct. The best kind of correct.
Hi, folks. This is from De Gulden Middenweg. Do you think that countries like Poland, Belarus, Romania, and Hungary are longing in secret to grab a piece of West UA as soon as the UA army is destroyed?
I think within each one of those nations, there are nationalist elements who dream of a greater, Romania, a greater Hungary. So they want to incorporate parts of their nations that are parts of Ukraine that have the Hungarian or the Romanian, majority populations, or at least significant presence. But here's the problem. Europe, at the end of the Second World War, they did a lot of population shifting and drawing lines on maps. And the feeling was that if they didn't solidify this, if they didn't say, okay, no more redrawing the maps, that you're going to have forever conflicts, because they're, yes, we drew a line on the map this time, but now in a couple of years, they're going to say, no, that's really ours. We're going to invade to recover it. The idea was to set everything in stone and say, this is what Europe looks like, and we're not going to be moving around. So all these nations that are listed there, if they suddenly say, well, it's okay to pick apart Ukraine, they're throwing away, 80 years of, of a decision that the lines are permanent. We're not going to allow, through force of arms to redraw the map of Europe. So it's, I think there's some elements that amongst their respective national movements that might be thinking in this direction, but I also think that there's people who are more cognizant of the larger European political picture, and understand that you can't go changing the lines on the map like that, because once you do that, it'll never end. It'll just keep war in Europe will never stop, because it'll keep trying to change the lines on the map.
Surah Vlogs, does talking about pain of war change decisions of any political power?
No, doesn't, because politicians, they don't care. But it doesn't mean that those who talk about war shouldn't talk about the pain of war. Just because our politicians opt out of participating in humanity.
Are there any exceptions that occur to you, Scott?
Not big players, not the people who are actively involved. They just make cold hard calculations. Lindsey Graham, American citizen.
It's so depressing. The number is zero. Wow.
It is depressing, but no, people get very callous at that. And even the people that talk, I mean, you're saying you can't be selective in your humanity. You know, there's a lot of people, oh, those poor Ukrainians are getting blown up and all that. But we don't care about Russian casualties or, you know.
Yeah. Fortunate Son, great song. Yeah. Yeah. Creedence Clearwater Revival sounds fresh today. It's amazing. I love that band.
Oh,
it's
a great song. The Jungle is a good war song too.
Yeah. Some songs, you know, that came out a long time ago, they sound, you know, production-wise, like they came out a long time ago.
Yeah.
I don't know, something about Creedence songs. It's just like, just as, they could be a contemporary, just a great sound to them.
Have another glass of wine, Jeff. They'll sound even better.
Oh, are you suggesting that I'm only a waxing poetic on Creedence because of the wine? Is that what you're suggesting?
I'm not suggesting anything, Jeff.
I think you are. All right. Let's go to another question so Scott doesn't continue to mock me for being in a good mood.
I'm not mocking you. I'm admiring you.
Oh, you are. Right. What do you got, Tori? Anything, sweetness? Are you out of questions? Did you pass out? There you are. I wouldn't be surprised. It's late for Tori, too. Big Daddy, I've been reading on the internet that the U.S. is trying to instigate the country of Georgia to open up a second front. What's your thoughts on that? Is that just propaganda?
Well, no. There was a very strong Georgian nationalist movement that was seeking to open up a second front with Russia under the premise that because Russia was losing in Ukraine, that Russia didn't have sufficient resources to...
Uh-oh. Did your dog just show up in Washington? Did Maverick follow you? Get on the...
but they're giving away the hotel. I'm in a dog-friendly hotel.
Wow. And there's no escaping the dogs.
And so people do bring their dogs here, and there's Maverick. That wasn't Maverick. That was...
I don't know. I don't believe it. I thought for sure there would be no dog sounds tonight, but all right, whatever.
Yeah. So the dogs stopped barking. I guess sometimes dogs, when their owners walk out the door, the dogs...
You know, it's probably somebody probably came into the room to turn down the bed and leave mints on the pillow.
The dog ate the chocolate, which that's why they're not going to put mints on the bed, because it's a dog-friendly hotel. But what were we talking about? What was the question, Jeff?
I don't even remember what day it is. Remember, I'm drinking heavily tonight, so what do I know? But Creedence is a great band. Ryan from Austin, our muscle-bound friend who has challenged you to arm wrestling.
Yeah, I'm working on it, Ryan.
Did Biden approve it? And Ryan, so you said you and Pat were going to go out to do a reconnaissance mission. So where's my report on that? Did Biden approve a new nuclear policy for using nuclear weapons against conventional weapons?
No. Biden continued an existing policy that's been in place since the administration of George W. Bush that allows nuclear weapons to be used in non-nuclear, under non-nuclear circumstances, to include preemptive use of nuclear weapons. You know, Joe Biden ran on a premise or on the promise that he would seek to redefine America's nuclear posture along the lines of what's called sole purpose. Sole purpose means that the sole purpose of America's nuclear deterrence is to deter against a nuclear attack against America by guaranteeing our ability to respond, therefore destroy. yeah. That's a good strategy. We brought it up.
Just put Maverick in a suitcase, no problem.
When we moved from Turkey to Germany, when I was a kid, we had two dogs and a cat. And so we drove, and everywhere we went, they wouldn't allow the dogs or the cat into the hotel. And so we tried on a couple occasions to, we'd check in, and then once we got all the kids in, me and my three sisters in the room, then we'd go out and we'd bring the pets in and sort of get them in there, and we'd walk them to make sure they went to the bathroom outside, and we were very assiduous. If there was any mess made, we'd clean it up, and we sprayed, and we did everything that we could. But we got to Milano, Italy, and we were spending the night before we made our way up over the Alps, and it was freezing, and we were able to get the cat into the hotel room, but the Italians saw the dogs and they said no. So the dogs had to sleep in the car. It was a van, and so we couldn't leave the dogs alone. So I had to sleep in the van with the dogs. So, and it was, I'm telling you, the temperature was, we had the bowl of water that we had in the car so the dogs could drink. And in the morning when my parents came to wake us up, I'm in a sleeping bag and the dogs are wrapped up in me in the sleep bag. And the bowl of water, this is solid ice. So, yeah.
Do you remember when we were in the, you were staying in the Culver City Hotel and we planned to shoot some video with you right before we brought you to the airport after you were in the LA area for a few events, like for 3 days. And when the guy I arranged to shoot it came in with his equipment, they said, oh, no, you can't do it because you didn't get a permit to shoot it. Now, this is in the hotel room that we paid for that you're staying in. You remember that?
Yeah.
And it was pouring rain and we had very little time. So it was not a good time to, you know, be driving around looking for some other place to do it. So I was getting very depressed and I'm looking out at the pouring rain. And do you remember this? And as I'm looking out into the pouring rain, wonder how we're going to get out of this. I saw the Actors Gang Theater just a 100 yards away, Tim Robbins Theater.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I thought, maybe somebody is there now and maybe they'll let us shoot there. So I called over there and I got somebody on the phone. I think it was their executive director. And I explained the situation. And she said, I love Scott Ritter. It would be an honor to have you. And then we went over there and we shot it.
I do. And that was also, wasn't Tom Morello playing there at some point in time?
Yeah, I think so. I'm not sure, but that sounds like something.
We were talking about Tom Morello during that thing. But yeah. To go back to the Georgian thing, there's Georgian nationalists who wanted to, who thought that they could take advantage of Russian weakness to open up a second front. And in doing so, they were operating under the illusion that they would be able to kick the Russians out of Abkhazia, which is a breakaway republic, kick them out of South Ossetia, which is a breakaway republic, and reunify Georgia. Fortunately, and they were egged on, I believe, by the CIA and others who were... Did my camera just go blurry or is that my eyes?
Yeah, it did. It did. It's probably the internet.
All right. I thought maybe I'm going blind. I was just like, well, that's interesting. But the...
I mean, I don't know. Sometimes you never know what the cause is, but I would guess it's Richie. Maybe you can give us your opinion. Is this probably an internet issue or a camera issue or a computer issue? Probably the internet. It's getting a little better now.
But I don't know. Maybe it's getting reflect. Who knows what's going on? But the CIA, I believe, was funding this to encourage this. Fortunately, Georgian politicians have. Been smarter than this, and they understand that would just be a suicide mission, and so they've indicated that they are not going to participate in any way, shape, or form in a conflict against Russia. I mean, my hand right there comes in very clear.
Yeah, so let's just get a close-up on it. Maybe we have a palm reader out there. People want to know when such and such is going to happen. Maybe we can read your palms to come up with that.
Look, I'm back.
Yes. Very clear, very clear. Medi, I remember Medi. As it is now, who can Putin or Lavrov sit down with that has not lied to them previously?
No one. No one in the West. The West is, they're all liars. That's just the sad truth.
No wonder I drink so heavily.
I don't blame you. I have a mini bar here, and I could literally go in right there. There's a bottle of bourbon staring me in the face.
Wow. It's bandwidth related. The stream down sample or the dog.
We'll go with the dog.
Anyway, we're basically hearing all your answers. We haven't really missed anything, so it's okay. All right, what else we have here? Irina, is that how to pronounce that name? O'Hara. sort of like Irish and Russian mixed together. Do you think Belarus will enter this war?
Well, they are indirectly. I mean, they're providing a platform. Russian troops came into Ukraine from Belarusian soil. Russian aircraft have taken off from Belarusian soil and fired missiles against Ukraine. And the Ukrainian army provides a strategic depth to the Russian operation. The Ukrainian president or Belarusian president said that one of his main jobs was to secure, the Russian rear. And what he means by that is to prevent the Baltic states or Poland from stabbing Russia in the back while they're, and so, even though it's not direct ground combat in Ukraine, Belarus is already part of this. Do I think Belarus will enter the war in terms of direct ground combat? Unfortunately, yes. If Poland, especially if Poland continues to, flex its jaws when it comes to, making a move on Western Ukraine, I think that would be unacceptable for Belarus. And the Belarusian president has said as such. And if that happened, I do believe that Belarusian soldiers would cross over into Ukraine to prevent Poland from securing a foothold in Western Ukraine.
All right. I will go as long and as late as you want, Scott, but for your sake, I am now going to propose three more questions. What is your position on that issue?
I'm going to support you on this one, Jeff, just because I think the reason why you're saying that is maybe I'm just not as bubbly as I should be, and I'm hurting the brand with my laconic.
I wasn't going to put it that way. I just simply want to give you a chance to recover. All right, let's go on to three more questions. Mr. Modi, Senator Sinema, oh yeah, that was big news today, quit the Dems. Your opinion on that? What might change? There's a good question. Have you, or maybe you didn't catch the news. Oh, you didn't catch the news. Well, the whole balance in the Senate changed now. She's the new She dropped out of the Democratic Party.
But is she Republican or independent?
Independent.
Is she going to caucus with the Democrats or the Republicans?
She says she's going to keep caucusing with the Democrats. So she hasn't really come. Well, I don't know. But on the other hand, well, then why do it? So it's, it's not.
Really I don't know. But if she can caucus with the Democrats, then they still have their vote advantage. This would have been bigger if she jumped out and became a Republican, or if she jumped out and became an independent caucusing with the Republicans.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know, but that the way the press is playing it, it is a game changer. I don't know.
Well, it's embarrassing. It's embarrassing to the Democrats. But look, the bottom line is, even in a 50-50 Senate, Kamala Harris is the tiebreaker. So, and unless you can get enough senators to jump to give you, that 60 vote mark, the 60 votes you need to override vetoes and things of that nature, we're just playing playing political games right here.
Thank you, Joe Cool. Mr. Cool. Two more questions from Glenn with two N's as opposed to one. Will Turkey get kicked out of NATO because they're not obeying their American overlords and were probably behind the terrorist attack in Turkey recently? What happened to that new pronunciation for Turkey?
Turkey, yeah. Well, the Turks can do it. No one else is. They're having a brand problem. I don't think anybody's buying into that brand.
This the is artist like formerly known as Ye. People are still calling him Kanye. It's hard to get people to change.
Well, I mean, you're still calling me Scott, but I prefer to be called,
William. William's Billy.
Billy. Billy Jr. No, first of all, there is no, I mean, I've read the charter, and you can't kick a NATO member out. There's no provision to kick a NATO member out. So who's going to kick NATO? Who's going to kick Turkey out of NATO? They could withdraw if they want to, but the idea that NATO can come together and kick Turkey—that's Canadian. I get it. That's funny, actually. That's funny, Turkey.
Uh-oh. All right, so let's do 10 more questions now.
Yeah, I'm back alive. You got me laughing now. But the No, you can't kick Turkey out. It would have to be Turkey deciding to leave NATO, not the other way around.
All right. So let's give our person of the year, Scott Ritter, a chance to recuperate and do just one more question. Once again, congratulations on that prestigious honor. And we now come to our... Yeah, no, well, you deserve it. You definitely deserve it. Let's come to our final question. You stated the only way to denazify Ukraine is to eliminate the ultranationalist Banderites or the cancer of Ukraine. How do you stop the cancer of Banderites? How do you say that word?
I know what you're saying. How do you stop the cancer of the diaspora of Bandera in Canada?
Okay.
Personified by Chrystia Freeland, or the diaspora of Western Ukrainians in the United States, personified by Victoria Nuland. Again, I continue to believe that the only way to destroy this ideology is to rip it out by the roots, that there can be no half measures. You can't allow the potential for it to go underground and fester. You can't leave Western Ukraine untouched so that these people, solidify their position and become even more rancid. But then the question now is, how do we do it in Canada and elsewhere, in the United States? To delegitimize it is the most important thing. Look, here in the United States, the Ku Klux Klan could form a political party and say we're running for office, but they've been so delegitimized, marginalized that if they did so, they'd get no support because people would recognize them for the white supremacist, odious, hateful, ideology that they are. I think that the same thing has to happen for anybody who supports. This would be like somebody trying to run for office in the 1950s who continues to openly support Adolf Hitler. They're not going to win an election because the vast majority of people are going to be repulsed by that. And what we need to do is get a situation, the mindset of most Americans and most Canadians, where when they say step on Bandera, there's a visceral reaction that says no. And so anybody who embraces this ideology should be rejected. So that way you don't get Chrystia Freeland's entering the politics and, you don't get Victoria Nuland's appointed to positions in government. Instead, they are disqualified because of their beliefs. And that's the state we have to get to here in the United States and in Canada. We can't, especially in the United States, freedom of speech is freedom of speech. I don't have to like what you're saying, but I have to defend your right to say it. And so if you want to sit there and parade with Bandera's portrait and sing Bandera songs and do whatever you want, fine. But we need to have the mainstream America feel repulsed by what you're doing so that you never again get traction in the body politic and have people in Congress who represent your odious ideology.
All right. I hope you don't mind that we're publicizing your event at the library next week. I asked you repeatedly for the info, and you never gave it to me. But
they haven't done me a banner yet. I sent you the info on an email, but there's no link.
Oh, I must have overlooked that email. Anyway, I found it, and there is a link actually. So it's on Substack. It's called internet search. You heard of the term Google? Google is kind of a generic term. You don't actually have to use Google, but I say internet search because there are different search engines out there. I found it. I'm a very industrious young man. So anyway, I thought that maybe you
are we emphasizing the industrious aspect of it or the young aspect of it?
Both, equal. Whatever. Okay. I thought maybe you wanted to keep it just private, but so you don't mind.
No.
You do want people to come. Okay. All right.
I encourage everybody to come.
That means we can't do the podcast at the usual day and time. Right. So we're going to do it on Thursday next week. Tuesday, as per usual, we'll have the lightning round of Ask the Inspector. And other than that, I guess things will be more
clean up the mess we've made tonight by cutting 30 minutes short.
Yeah, that's all right. People understand. Tori's tired too. Give her a chance to.
Hey, you know what? We're finishing at our normal time.
I know we are, but that's exactly what my thought was. Thank you, Tori. Great job backstage. Thanks to our beloved audience, everyone, in particular those who contributed financially so that I can afford to maintain my weekly pedicure schedule. Got to have nice-looking toenails. So important. See you guys Tuesday, 3 p.m. What? Eastern time. What?
Where's my pedicure?
Oh, all right. We'll siphon off some of the money for your pedicure, too. All right. Take care.